Copyright Forum of Christian Leaders. The contents contained on this website are solely for your own individual, non-commercial, and informational use. Any other use is strictly prohibited without our express prior written consent. See the full copyright disclosure at focalonline.org.
There really are some significant opportunities, I think, for all of us in this arena. And what we're doing in our practice is we're encouraging all of our clients, you know, literally around the world to really focus on legacy giving and make that at least a significant initiative, a part of their overall development program, by providing examples, perhaps of people who have done it and the joy that they found in doing it, totally understanding that, the real fruit of it is not going to be realized until a later time in their life expectancy, but the realities are just knowing that they had the opportunity of doing that, and the ownership that they took of what it is that was yours is going to be exceptionally valuable. So I want you to kind of think about that for a while. Well, in this next section, we want to talk about what's happening in the world of philanthropy, and we're going to talk specifically about the millennials. The millennials is a name that basically we use to talk about three generations, but predominantly the final two, but there's the X, Y, and Z gens. I'm not sure what happens after Z. Maybe that's when the Lord comes back. I'm not really sure what that happens or what that means. I think if I were somebody that was born in the next generation, I'd be a little bit concerned, But the X, Y, and Z gens, let me just tell you a little bit about them. The X generation is those born between 1980 and 2000, or 1964 and 1980. They are called the busters, or the X generation. There's about 45 million of them. They give about 12% of all the money that's being raised in America today. They're generous, a lot like their fathers. The older busters, or the older X gens, look more like their dads. The younger X gens look a little bit more like the millennials. They tend to be a little bit more interested in what it is that's happening in the world. They kind of look at their fathers as being a little bit hypocritical because dad's way of doing things. This is very, very characteristic of the millennials, those subsequent Y and Z gens. They kind of look at their fathers as being hypocritical. And the reason why they see them that way, despite the fact that they respect their elders, but they still see them as being hypocritical because dad's way of doing things was to write a check. In other words, you mean there's a problem in Africa, in the Congo? Oh, I had no idea. Oh, my gracious. And he'll reach down and he'll write a check and, here's $1,000. Go do something about it. And they see that as hypocritical. While the millennials say, let's go do something about it. That's the one distinctive difference between the millennials and this generation is they want to get dirty. They want to get their hands into things. They want to become involved. I wrote a book a few years ago entitled, You Snooze, You Lose. And the whole book was written around the fact that if you go to bed tonight thinking you're going to wake up tomorrow morning and everything's going to be the way it was 20 years ago, and money's going to be flourishing, and there's going to be an awful lot of it that's going to be used and given to charity so that we can continue to do what it is that we do. If you think that's going to happen, then the realities are you're going to lose some of the greatest opportunities that God has ever given a generation to reach another generation with the gospel of Jesus. And so the point is, you snooze, you lose, and a number of if you write a book, somebody's going to review it. And so there were a number of reviews, and I think most of the people that read it thought, well, this is really interesting, and he had some interesting ideas. But there was one reviewer that found one sentence that I had made in the book, and he said, that sentence alone said what the problem is. And basically the sentence that I wrote was this: it would be more likely for a millennial to make an impulsive decision to go to Uganda for a year than to put $10 in an offering plate. And therein lies the issue. You see, they don't trust the church in many instances with their money, but they trust themselves to be able to facilitate change. And if you, you know, once we come to the realities of that, and I'm not suggesting that's true of everyone, but not, once we come to the realities of the fact that these young people are different and they have a different focus on life, the quicker we can accommodate and meet their needs in ways that are going to enable us to grow our ministries. And that's just the realities of life as we know it. I have some statistics here somewhere, here it is, that basically talks about some of the characteristics of these millennials, and I think you'll find it to be really, really interesting. And we have done in our practice a lot of research to try to understand millennials, because we realize that if we're going to continue to have success in reaching them, we really need to know what's important to them. And so, before we do that, let's just talk about the Y gens. The Y generations is 1980 to 2000, and there's about 60 million or so of those. And then the balance, the Z generation, which are basically, you know, 15 and under, represent the balance. And again, they represent about another 60 million. So you have about 125 million Y and Z gens, 125 million builders and boomers. And so just like the millennials or the builders and boomers shape their generation, these two final groups that we're talking about are going to shape theirs. Now, let's talk about some of the characteristics of millennials. And I'm going to just read statistics. These are all validated. We have the references and so forth to validate the statements that we're making. But here's just a few of them, and I think you'll find them to be interesting. 9 out of 10 millennials believe it is their responsibility to make a difference in the world. 90% of them. I mean, that's pretty amazing. I mean, they really do have a vision. They really do believe in themselves. They have a great deal of self-confidence. You know, they're extremely well-educated. The best educated generation in American or world history. Many in your country never had the opportunity of a higher educational experience, and now, you know, this generation has the opportunity and oftentimes, you know, really leverages it for their benefit in really knowing and understanding the world of which they're a part. But 9 out of 10 of them believe it is their responsibility to make a difference in the world. 3 out of 4 of them believe their role is to serve others. Now just stop and think about that for a moment. Because we think that they're really selfish. We think oftentimes where our perception is that they only care about themselves. But the realities are they really do have a sense. 75% of them say, we really want to serve others. We want to meet the needs of others less fortunate than ourselves. They've seen their parents as being a bit luxurious in the things that they've done. And when they go, and perhaps you've experienced this. I've experienced it frequently. Where someone, you know, who comes from a very wealthy home, have had all the benefits of luxury that could be afforded to them, and they go to a missions trip someplace else in the world, and they come back and they've not only been changed, but they've become resentful of what it is that they had in their lives. You know, here are people that are suffering. Here are people that, you know, can't get a meal hardly on a day-to-day basis. And they come back and they're being very, very critical of the lifestyle of their parents because they've seen a world differently than we ever saw in most instances. Most of us didn't really get outside our world until we were older, and then we became a little bit more aware of what was going on. 6 out of 10 millennials, 60% of them, believe they will make some great contribution in their lifetime. I mean, they have so much self-confidence, and they have so much desire to make a difference. I mean, they literally believe that they can make a world, and they can change the world, and they want to make a great contribution. It's interesting to me that among the millennials, while the average size gift is by and large quite low compared to that of the builders and the boomers, there are millennials that are making a large amount of money, and they're giving it away. The Facebook founder, you know, gave a significant portion of his wealth, $1 billion of wealth that he's accumulated in the course of his short life, actually is giving it away. And that is the case with many millennials who are raising these large fortunes who realize that they have a responsibility to the world of which they're a part, which was not necessarily the same with their grandparents and their parents, although we obviously know of the many that did do that, but there were many more that did not of those earlier generations. The balance between work and life is the number one factor in job selection for millennials. Now, we repeat that because I think that's a very important point. The balance between work and life is the number one factor in job selection for millennials. Now, I don't know if you've had this experience, but many millennials, their average tenure at any given place in America is about, 24 to 36 months. In other words, they'll stay with an organization for 2 or 3 years, but then if the work of the organization interferes with their life and their family, they'll leave something to go to something else, and they'll do it relatively quickly without too much thought. They feel like they have the work skills to find a job elsewhere, and so they're not terribly concerned about it. But the realities are, if you were to offer them, and this happened to me, someone offered to me, early in my career that if I would work 10 more hours a week, they'd give me $20,000 more a year. And I said, I'm in. And so here I am working, more hours than I probably should, taking away time from my family and my children as they were growing up so that I could raise more money to establish our home. And I'm thinking I was doing something really noble. And they don't see it that way. And they say that if I have to work later, I'm not going to stay. I mean, we're just not going to go on and do this. We're going to do something else because I want time with my family, I want time with my children, and I don't want to be like my dad. And quite frankly, I've had that told to me by my sons. Dad, you were gone a lot. You were gone an awful lot. You were doing a lot of very good things, and we're proud of you for that reason. But the reason I'm not going to be that way. We're not going to raise our children that way. And I hope that doesn't offend you, which it didn't offend me, but it made me hurt, realizing that I missed a portion of their lives because I perceived life's importance in a totally different way. And so I'm not critical of that, but that's obviously a reality that's true among the millennials. 3 out of 4 millennials would like a leader to come alongside them and teach them leadership skills. In other words, we don't necessarily respect you for the way of life that you chose, but we respect you for your knowledge and your wisdom, and so we really want to experience from you what it is that you know so that we can be better at it. And that's commendable. I mean, I don't know about you, but those of us that are, a little bit older, I think we all ought to be Pauls with a few Timothys in our lives, that we're going to mentor others. And I have the wonderful joy of mentoring a lot of different people who have asked me to help them and to meet with me. And I have breakfast probably 3 or 4 times a week when I'm home with different people that basically I've had the joy of being able to mentor. And they're kind of picking my brain, and I'm trying to help them in the ways that I can. But the realities are that's what they're looking for. And many of them look for many mentors to help them in certain aspects of their lives that they really want to hone and to make better. More than 40% of adult millennials currently have a mentor in their lives. So 40% of them do. So that's a fairly significant percentage. 70% of all millennials say the smartphone is vital in their lives. they just depend upon their smartphones. And if you see them on airports and if you see them anywhere, they're texting all the time, they're receiving texts, they're communicating. They can go onto the internet now with their phone. I've been talking on my phone to my wife and FaceTime so I can see her, she can see me. I mean, this is something that never existed in the context of our lives. I can still remember getting off airplanes looking for phone booths. Well, now I get off airplanes and you'll never see a phone booth at an airport because nobody uses them anymore. But the realities are the phone has become a very integral part of communication. The average email is read within 3 to 4 days. The average text message is responded to in less than 10 minutes. And so people are communicating via text, they're communicating with one another. It's almost instant communication. That's what they want and that's the way that they live. The most accessible way to reach a millennial is by text. And if you have teenagers or if you have grown adult children, you know that. I can call them, they don't answer the phone. I can email them, they don't answer email. I can text them and I'll get a message within 10 seconds or 10 minutes. And those are adult kids. Our children, you know, are not children anymore. I mean, my youngest is like 48, and my oldest is 48, my youngest is 46, and they don't answer their phone, and they don't have a checkbook. Not one of my boys could write a check, because I don't think they know how to write a check. They do everything online, as perhaps your children do. I mean, they just live differently. And I asked them one time for a check, and they didn't even know what I was talking about. All right, 70% of millennials believe the government should provide for their retirement. 70%. And for them, I would suggest they move to Norway or to someplace where that's probably going to happen, but it's probably not going to happen in America, and I don't know about your country as well. Millennials are the least religious of any generation. About 35% of them attend church. 35% of 125 million are attending church. So they're the least religious. Typically, when children leave home at 18 to go to college, or 19 when they leave to go to college, they leave the church at about the same time. And if churches, and we have done lots of study, because a lot of the work that we do in America is with churches and other nonprofit organizations, but in churches, if the majority of the people in your church look a little bit like me, you know, they have gray hair and they look a little bit old, the realities are you're probably not going to have a church in 6 to 10 years. We've lost about 30% of the churches in America in the last 3 years. You know, while there are new churches growing, they don't look like the old churches. Many of them look like coffee shops. They look like, you know, places where people would be willing to come and not necessarily be associated with a church, but they want to become engaged, and so they're willing to reach out to people because they find this as a place where we can minister, not just one day a week on Sunday, but we can minister 7 days a week, you know, to the community of which we're a part. There's an awful lot of really creative things happening in the world today. 75% of millennials say that they are spiritual, but not religious. Now, isn't that interesting? They are spiritually minded, they're concerned about spiritual issues, but they don't consider themselves as being religious. They make a distinction there. And maybe that's a healthy distinction, that they really are searching for answers, and hopefully they're finding many of us able, or hopefully they can find most of us able to respond to their needs in ways that are basically going to enable them to understand spirituality in a totally different way. Most millennials are unable to define their beliefs. They know that they have them, but they can't define them. They know that they believe in heaven, but they really don't know why, perhaps because somebody told them that it existed. 65% of millennials do not regularly attend church. We've already talked about that. And millennials who are leaving home are also leaving the church. We've already said that. 86%, listen to this. This is interesting. 86% of millennials plan to marry once or not at all. 86%. They wait later to marry, but when they marry, they're committed to staying at one time married. And that is a particularly interesting statistic. There may be situations that occurred prior to the marriage, but once they make that decision to marry, which oftentimes is much later than it was during our generation, they make that commitment once and for all. 90% of millennials don't have a checkbook. Well, we already know that. And those that do rarely write one. And that would be true. I don't think either of my sons have checkbooks, by the way. 94% of millennials respect older generations, despite the fact that they think they have been somewhat hypocritical in the practice of their beliefs. And those are things that we've talked about already. So the question becomes, as we try to bring this to some level of conclusion, well, what do we do about all of this? We know that they're givers. We know that they have broad levels of interest. We know that they want to be involved. We want them to be engaged. And I think it's important for us to provide opportunities that meet the needs and their desires. You know, the first thing that I would recommend, that if you don't have a millennial on your board, your organization's board, then you should do that as soon as possible. You know, find those that are in their early 30s and people who basically have a little bit of experience in life, but do understand the situation that exists around them. And if you can find at least two or three millennials, you should have, you know, probably 25 to 30% of your board representing that generation, because they represent, you know, the future of the world. And they're going to tell you, and they will tell you bluntly, you know, what you may be doing wrong or what you could improve on. But what you have to listen to is what it is they have to say, because it's of great value. We believe, and I believe personally, that micro-giving is going to be a significant player in the future of philanthropy. And what I mean by micro-giving is gifts of $100 or less a year. And so we're talking about gifts of $100 or less a year, so that might be $20 or whatever. The point is that what they have is they have so many diverse interests that they want to distribute their money in ways that are going to help the most people, which means that they're not going to just give one to one organization, they're going to give to several organizations, and the average size gift is going to be lower. We're building a platform, our company's building a platform, it's a micro-giving platform that allows individuals to give gifts as low as $3.65 a year, that's a penny a day, to 5 cents a day, which is $18.25 a year, and it can go up to 25 or 30 cents a day, but we're talking about it in those kinds of increments. The commitment is done, you know, online in most instances. The commitment is made online or through a cell phone or a mobile phone. There's a lot of interesting things that are happening, especially in Africa right now, in terms of how transactions are taking place, you know, with mobile devices. But there are a variety of ways in which it's being done, but wherein people can make those kinds of gifts. Now, we're working on a project in America right now that we're pretty excited about. And just let me tell you what this would mean. This is kind of a vision of mine, but we've always been very, very heavily involved. Our company's always been heavily involved in the pro-life movement because we just believe in it. There have been 55 million babies that have been aborted since 1974 in Roe versus Wade, or 1973 in Roe versus Wade, the Supreme Court decision that allowed abortions to take place. 55 million abortions. And so we came up with this idea, wouldn't it be something if we could find 55 million people in America who'd be a voice for one of those children? Because they didn't have a voice, they couldn't express themselves, they couldn't talk, they didn't have the opportunities, despite the fact that they were alive at the time that they were taken. And if 55 million people, just to show you what this could mean, if 55 million people were to give 5 cents a day. Now, I know I can find 55 million people that would give 5 cents a day. I mean, there's nothing more emotional to people than the pro-life issue. And either you're pro-life or pro-choice in America. And pro-lifers, the one thing about pro-lifers is that they're adamant about it. They really believe strongly about this. And I'm only asking you to give 5 cents a day, you know, to do this. $18.25, 55 million people giving $18.25 a year is over $1 billion. A year that could be placed into situations where we can start to work on the real problem, which is not abortion. The real problem is our lack of belief in the sanctity of human life. Because all we're doing through the pro-life movement it's a symptom that we're dealing with, that abortion even takes place, because we've lost the value of the sanctity of life. And so if we can get 55 million people to do that, but if you can get 100,000 people, if you can get 10,000 people to do $18.25, remember what that would mean, you know, to the work of your organization. And I really believe that something has got to shift, and we strongly have committed ourselves to this as a company, because we believe that if we don't do something, then we're really going to be in a world of hurt in the future. But think of the value of that, by the way. Because if you had 55 million people, just from a legislative standpoint, this would be the largest lobby in American history. And so now, if legislation is being proposed that is not pro-life, we have a voice. I mean, a pretty significant voice. If 55 million people send a letter to their senator, it's going to create, you know, a bit of a problem to the Postal Service. The whole point is that it does give us leverage that we don't have now. And it seems to me that the body of Christ should be the one that takes the lead on all of this. But it's just anything that organizes. And by the way, it basically the way it works out in many instances, that at the anniversary that they made their first gift, it automatically rebuilds because we're asking them to do that every year. So that's $18.25 a year, every year, until they finally say no. And we've developed a program where they can actually create a portfolio of maybe 20 organizations. If they gave to 10 organizations, that's $182.50. That's not very much money, but they're giving to 10 organizations. And that's exactly what millennials love. They want to be able to participate in the world of which they're a part. And if I can give you $18.25 at a time or $3.65 at a time, I can do more and more and more to reach the challenges that face the world today. So we really strongly believe in micro-giving. A revenue-generating facilities. This is one of the things that we're doing in our country, where basically we are building facilities that have revenue sources. When it comes to building these new church buildings, which are looking like coffee shops, in fact, that's exactly what they are, we're building those with investor revenue and not gift revenue. In other words, we're not trying to raise money for these. We're seeking to get engaged investors who hold a good part of the debt for a period of time. We're paying them interest on their investment. But after 7 or 8 years, after they have depreciated everything that they can depreciate off their personal taxes, then after that, they gift their portion of the ownership of the limited liability company. They gift it back to the nonprofit. The nonprofit continues to take what it is they were paying donors to pay off whatever remaining balance exists, but it allows us to get things done using investors rather than donors. And let me tell you something, that in the world of philanthropy today, it's easier to get investors than donors. And there are ways that we're doing that in very creative ways so that we can reach more people. We're doing a series of things called Christian Community Colleges, which that's a very significant factor in the world today in education. We have a huge problem in America with student debt. Many students have gone to college, and they can accumulate debt because it's really easy to accumulate. You know, most organizations are willing to give it to you, anxiously willing to give it to you. And so they kind of spend it freely, not realizing that there's going to be a responsibility sooner or later to deal with it. And so they graduate with $50,000 worth of debt or $100,000 worth of debt. And then they happen to fall in love with somebody at the same university who has $100,000 worth of debt. And now we have somebody that's getting married with $200,000 worth of debt. And basically that's a recipe for disaster. And marriages fall apart because they can't deal with it. And there's I think 80% of all the student debt basically that's been accumulated in the world today is default right now. And it's billions of dollars. And so that's why presidential candidates like Bernie Sanders you know, are basically promising the fact that we'll just take care of that. You know, and essentially what that will mean is obviously that somebody's going to have to take care of it because it's debt that's been accumulated. And the point is, I'm not, you know, speaking against a presidential candidate, and I know that sounded that way, but the whole point is that we just can't continue to do business the way we've always done it and expect different results. We're beginning right now in our country a network of Christian community colleges. The community college, there are community colleges throughout our country, two-year colleges where people can get their core courses out of the way for a price that they can afford, and then they go on to another university to finish their degree programs. Well, there are no Christian community colleges, or there were no Christian community colleges several years ago. And we took the initiative, our company took the initiative of helping to a couple of colleges to establish satellite campuses, which became Christian community colleges. And it's made it possible for parents to get the value-based Christian education they want at a price that they can afford to pay it. But if they don't have that, then they're going to go to public institutions, which oftentimes don't hold the same values that are important to us. And so we think the Christian community college project is very, very important. And then finally, among other things that we could be talking about, what's happening in the world today is what, and the hottest word in philanthropy in the world today is collaboration. You know, years ago, we were trying to build empires. I mean, men were trying to build empires because others had built them before. You know, the Rockefeller Empire, and you can just go on and on and on and talk about people who built these great empires. And so people that were really aggressive and entrepreneurial tried to establish their own empires. And certainly in the Christian world, there were those in America, you know, that started to, you know, build, you know, empires, and basically they were the king of the empire. Well, the realities are, most of us have come to the conclusion that we're not going to be able to do that on our own. And so now we're seeing collaborative efforts, and it's the most encouraging thing that I see, you know, in the world today, is people are coming together and working together for the first time. They're willing to say, you know, we can't do this alone, but we can do it together. So let's let your organization and our organization and your organization and your organization, let's work together, because together we can do more than we can do alone. And that's one of the more exciting things that I've seen happening in the world today. So life is changing, as we all know. The millennials are making a difference, as we all know. They have a presence, as we all know. And the realities are, what are we going to do about it? And that's the opportunity that's before us.